Good evening, everyone. We started out with only a handful of people, and as the clock turned, people filtered in, and we still have people arriving. So it's interesting. We just never know. Things change all the time. And it occurred to me today that sometimes it seems like false advertising to say that I will give a Dharma talk. Because all things are Dharma. Everything is giving a Dharma talk all the time. So singling out this moment, this person, this place, this time, we know why we do that. And at the same time, I feel not bound by that either. For example, while I was making lunch today, I picked up a pan that was on the stove, but th that had nothing in it, and the burner under the pan was not lit. But the pan was next to a pot in which there was water boiling. So I took the handle of the pan and it burned my fingers, these fingers. And direct experience of not what I expected. And yet I had no problem reacting. It didn't correspond to what I ex had expected that I would find. But in that split second, there was no thought. I just dropped the pan back down. Fortunately, it didn't overturn the pan with the boiling water, but it could have because it was such a direct reaction. And then there were consequences from that. I had to dig around in my cupboard to find this. We have this magic French product that's called Biafine, which works wonders on burns. Had to dig around in my cupboards for it, and then continuing to make my lunch was very complicated because I couldn't use my left hand really. The fingers were burning, and then it was covered with this white cream. So I couldn't really use my left hand, and it was direct experience then of ooh, how do I usually function, and then how do I function now, given that circumstance? And then the consequences went on throughout the afternoon. Up until now, so sitting differently with my hand that I still has this cream on it, and it still hurts. So, all of this was Dharma talk, you know, all of this was Dharma teaching. Direct experience of what is, and then the ongoing letting go of things are not what I think they are, and then experiencing them new again and again and again, every moment throughout the day. You don't have to burn your hand to have this experience, but that just so happens what happened to me. And so I'm seizing on this as an example. So when I think of it in these terms, that everything is a Dharma, when I was about 12 years old, I saw the movie Jesus Christ Superstar, which was this huge hit when about that time. First, it had been a Broadway show, and then it became a film. And with my friends, we I don't know how we did it because in those days you couldn't, stream online or something. But I think we went to the cinema several times to see it, and then you could buy the soundtrack because it was a musical, right? So we had the vinyl, the soundtrack, and we listened to that thing over and over again. But there was a scene in the movie where when Christ comes back to Jerusalem on what has come to be called Palm Sunday. And he's greeted by the people with palms, and the Roman soldiers are there too. And they come and they try to stop him from entering Jerusalem because he was seen as a real, this radical, subversive, element that they didn't want disrupting the order of things, right? So they tried to keep him from entering Jerusalem, and he said, and this, I think there's probably something similar in the Bible, but this was the line in the film, even a song, I think it was. He said, "You can stop me. You can silence me. But the rocks and plants will keep saying it." And as a 12-year-old girl, this was illuminating. I mean, I was just like, wow, awakened to something that I never occurred to me before. And stuck with me, that really stayed with me that. And so when I talk about this tonight, saying, everything is the Dharma, that's what I'm talking about. Christ was saying the same thing. Or there's a story of one of the Christian desert fathers who lived in a cave in Egypt, as a hermit. And someone asked him, I don't know in what context, how he could live without books and scripture. How could he pursue his Christian devotion and practice without the Bible and scripture, And he said, "Wherever I look, I see the book of creation. It's laid out before me. It's the same thing as the Dharma is everywhere." So, and Zen, so that you can understand why Zen appealed to me when I stumbled upon it, because it was saying the same thing as, as the line from Jesus Christ Superstar. It's outside the scriptures, it's outside the sutras, the Zen teaching. The Dharma is everywhere. All things are Dharma. Everything's a teaching. So my burned fingers are a teaching. And so I go through the day and I pick up these, stones and twigs and burned fingers and encounters I had throughout the day, something I read in the newspaper. And then I sit down here with you and I unfold these things that are nothing special, but they are the Dharma. Everything is special. Everything is a teaching. It helps. So then we say, okay, well, why do we even do this? Why do we sit here and pretend that someone is giving a Dharma talk when all we have to do is walk outside or look in our refrigerator or look in our trash can. Well, it helps to have it to direct our attention in a certain way because we're not paying attention really. So when we take our trash out to be taken away, we're not thinking at all about that as Dharma. When we're throwing things into the trash, we don't think of that as Dharma. We don't, when we burn our fingers, usually we don't think of that as Dharma teaching. We don't think of that as Zen. So it helps to have our attention brought to it. And so, like, as we say, the famous Zen saying of the finger pointing to the moon. So, what we call the Dharma talk is the finger pointing to the moon. But actually, it's not so much about the Dharma talk, it's about the moon. There's the koan of I think it's, or it's not actually a koan, it's a story. We, in fact, I don't think we study it as a koan, but I think it's Kyogen, who became famous for the man up a tree, which was another koan. But when he was a young Zen student and practicing with his teacher, and he, I forget exactly what he asked his teacher, but it was, something like, what is the most important teaching, or what, how can I put my mind at rest? All these standard questions we have. What is the meaning of Buddhism or something? And the teacher, sent him off to look, and he came back and he couldn't find it. And so he begged his teacher to tell him. He said, "Can't you tell me what it is?" And his teacher said, "Yes, I could tell you, but if I did, you would never forgive me." And so he's very discouraged. He doesn't get this, So he goes off and pursues his practice. I think the teacher dies, and spends 20 years working in the garden, basically, of a monastery somewhere. And one day, while he's working in the garden, a stone that he's raking flies up and hits a tree. Sometimes we say it's a bamboo stalk, but it's, or a tree, something. It's some living plant that was strong enough to, when the stone hit it, it made a noise. And when he heard that, suddenly everything fell away. All of his ideas about himself, about what this practice was, about what he was looking for, his attachments about life and death, true dharma, secret meanings, dharma talks, whatever, it all fell away. And suddenly he could see what, like the Desert Father, the book of creation laid before his eyes. Everything was it. He was it. And then he composed a poem, which we do use as a koan. The first lines are the sound of something struck, and everything has been forgotten. Something like that. Like, my hand burning the, grabbing the pan, and everything is forgotten. Of course, with Kyogen's, in his story, maybe many times he had been working in the garden and something was struck and he didn't hear it, or he heard it, but he was still caught up in his ideas about things, and not, it wasn't the right moment, Or let's say it wasn't the moment when that something, when he heard that something struck, just that, without an idea about it, without projections, without being caught up in his other trains of thought, whatever else he was doing. So, can we view all phenomenon, all events, all people, every moment as a teacher, say? Sometimes we say it's a dharma, but it's a teacher. Which means not looking for something else, not looking to be somewhere else, not having a fixed idea about what it means to see things as they are, even something like that. Gary Snyder, the poet, who we read one of his texts, I think, in the study group. I forget, didn't we? Yeah, we did. Who I identify, or who I have an affinity for because he's a Zen poet too. So, and he makes this distinction. He said, to really be home right here now, we have to accept our ignorance. We have to accept not knowing. Because if we think we know or we have an idea about what home is or to be here right now, we will miss it. We'll miss where we are right now. We'll miss this Dharma teaching that is right now. And he says that's what makes that's the difference between a poet and a journalist, is the journalist thinks they know and the poet thinks they don't know or doesn't know. Well, I happen to be a poet and a journalist, so I took this when I read this as I see the difference when I was practicing as a journalist before I started my Zen practice. And then practicing as a journalist after I started this practice. And I think I see what he means about the journalist before I started this practice. Believing that we know, and therefore it's quite limited. So we need the facts and we investigate according to these facts. And I think that the best journalists actually, I wouldn't say they're all Zen practitioners, but they let go of knowing because that opens to creativity. And that's what happened with me when I started my practice, was I became a much better journalist because I had so much more space in which to understand things, to read things, to discover things, to uncover things, to present, to write in a way that was best, that was most appropriate for readers, because I had let go of knowing, let go of thinking that it had to be a certain way. And I became much freer, and I became a much better journalist, and a much better poet, actually too. And then, but this is a practice of every moment for all of us. You don't have to be a poet or a journalist. I mean, it applies to your whatever you do as your, earn your living, as we say, which is such a weird expression, that we have to earn our life, right? But whatever you do as your livelihood, as we say, this is also true for you. That when you open to book of creation is laid open before you, that frees you then to when you look at whatever your job is for that day, or the project you're working on, or the meeting with colleagues, or the deadlines you have. It really does open the space. And then you see that this is your dharma, that this is dharma right now. This is teaching. Because we chant at night, or we chant after our sittings, usually at night in retreats. Life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by. Don't squander your life. So, because at the end of our life, doesn't matter how many diplomas you have, or how much money you've made, or what position you've risen to in your profession, or how many beautiful cars and houses you have, or the amazing wardrobe you've acquired. That's not what matters. What matters is who you are right now, of this now, here. We're actually, every moment we're preparing for our death, because we know that's where we're going, right? But if we're focusing on that moment when we will die, we miss what it is to live. And the best way to prepare for death is to live fully. I had this tea bag today. I didn't notice I bought this tea. And on the tea bag, the brand of the tea, or at least that's what it said on the tea bag, was live fully. Teaching. Dharma talk right there on my tea bag. Because that's the best way to die, is to live totally now, to live fully, to give yourself entirely to what is here and now. Someone to, oh, yes, my sister, my older sister, last night was talking about when she was a child and my parents sent her to summer camp. She hated it. And she was really, really homesick. And I never had heard this story before. And so one of the counselors came to her and said, "I understand you're homesick. It's really common. We're all homesick. It's not a problem. And you will go home again. Don't worry. And your parents love you and all this." But she said to my sister, "But you know what you can do now about that is, if you really fully engage with whatever the activities are, so when you're canoeing or when you're singing around the campfire or when you're whatever they were doing at the camp, the summer camp, whatever the activity is, if you really put yourself into it completely, you'll see it's different. Your homesickness will be different." And my sister said this was like an illumination, that she did it, she tried it, and it did. It actually made a difference. She didn't feel homesick, at least during those moments when she was really engaged with the activity. She never went to summer camp again because she hated it so much. But she did, and she really said that was a life lesson for her from that counselor. And it stayed with her till this day. And my sister is like, almost, well, yeah, she's almost 70. And she said it served her throughout her life. And that's, my sister knows nothing about Zen, does not practice Zen, but that's what we're talking about. It's like, no separation. Give yourself to it entirely, whatever it is. Live fully now, because of course it's not going to last, right? This moment will not last. And this is all you have, actually. So be here now, right? Or get, Gary Snyder says, be at home right now, right here. There's nowhere else to be at home. This is where you are, and give yourself entirely to where you are, and then you have no regrets. So, I don't want to say so. When you burn yourself, really burn yourself. But that's kind of what happened. It's like, ah, and I dropped the pan immediately. It was just direct, Cursed the pan. It's not a good pan anyway. It's one of these pans that is. Someone gave us these pans because they didn't want them, but they're for induction cooking. And so the handles, apparently, when they're on flames, or I don't know, maybe when they're on induction, I don't know, they're hot, which I think that's silly that they should put some sort of protection around the handle, but anyway. So I cursed the pan, I cursed the person who gave me the pans, everything, whatever. And yet it was a great teaching. Great teaching. And I think all of my years of Zen practice and my moment-to-moment attention to it helps me to see that and to appreciate that for what it was. Not that I want to burn my fingers, but if that's what happens, it's, I can appreciate it and I can give myself to it entirely.
And you were immediately relieved to have a topic for the Dharma talk.
Well, no, actually, I didn't think about it as a topic of Dharma talk until I was sitting, until I sat, I was like, what am I going to talk about? Because earlier today, for 2 hours before this, I had an hour and a half break, but for 2 hours before that, I was on another Zoom meeting for the class I teach around healthy boundaries. And it's a completely different kind of group, and what I'm not expected to give a Dharma talk, but I had to be fully there too, If I was sitting there during that 2 hours thinking about what my Dharma talk would be, well, I wouldn't have really been there. And earlier in the day, I had something else to do. I had to go over the proofs of the book that's coming out in May. And so I had to give myself entirely to that. If I didn't, well, I would have missed something in those proofs if I was thinking about, oh, this is going to be my Dharma talk. Or what am I going to talk about? Or what am I going to make for lunch? Or, whatever. So, as the counselor said to my sister, I just try to give myself entirely to whatever it is. So no, I didn't think that would be my Dharma talk tonight. But and even while I was sitting, I didn't know if that would be my Dharma talk, but I knew that that was a teaching. And so maybe that was what, oh, so everything is a teaching. That's a teaching, but everything is a teaching.
If we made it into a koan, then you would be enlightened at once.
What do you mean?
If you turned your story and made it into a koan, the end of the ko the end of the story would be, and she was enlightened at
Oh,
once.
yes. And she experienced great enlightenment. Yeah, that's true. And then, it would become this thing of like, oh, these Zen teachers, they encourage you to burn your hands. And and then it would go down through the ages as then that would be a practice when we would, have burning pans in the Zendo see what we do immediately. Yeah.
That could be fun though, if we could do it just once. No? No.
I
Okay,
don't
no.
know.
I'll be, that's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, well, it's amazing, huh? Where we can go with it. And but you're rightly so to point out that the koans are all those kinds of things. They're just stories that happened. They're incidents, they're exchanges, experiences that have been seized upon and used as to help us point to us that the Dharma is everywhere. So maybe I'll stop there and we'll see what other the rocks and trees and people in their little squares on the screen will say.
Yeah, I can start. Hi everyone, and thank you Roshi for that. It really just what comes up for me is this always this thing I was pondering about how is that the word Dharma means at the same time phenomena and the teachings, and how does that work? And I think what you said also, it's as if there is a movement. It's like, how do you make it so that the phenomenon becomes a teaching, and how with the teachings you start to see phenomenon as teachings. And in that movement, in the middle of that movement lies, it's like the question of how do we understand that? And that's the whole path. And with that, we probably do need, words and teachers and practices and coherence discourses, that suddenly we kind of start to understand that these phenomenons are teachings, and so that we can look back at the phenomenons, something like that, to that extent. So the words, because you started as like, we could just not say it, but at the same time, then it just becomes phenomenon, and it's like, where do we, how do we bring that into a teaching? Anyway, that's, I think that's, I hope that's clear.
Yeah. Looks like Pedro has his hand up.
Yeah. Thank you, Roshi, for your talk. So, I'm just struck by what Joa has said, which is really interesting. But what I sort of wanted to say is that I think it was yesterday that I was listening to Eckhart Tolle, one of his YouTube talks, and he was talking, he sort of gave up this idea that I thought, that's brilliant, because now what's happening is very exciting for me at this point, because there's lots of stuff. The stuff that I'm coming across in Zen and Buddhism is starting to feed my practice as a psychologist, So then, and that's really exciting. And it doesn't feel forced. It feels that I'm listening to things, and then suddenly I'm in a session with somebody, and oh, there it goes, So that's very cool, because I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm not forcing it. I just don't know what's going to happen next. And then that happens. So Eckhart Tolle was talking about how resisting giving in to impulses can be a spiritual practice designed for you. So what did he mean by that? What did I understand that he meant by that? So you come home, there's maybe different things to do, or there's a difficult conversation with somebody that you live with that you don't want to have. So you see yourself getting the remote and switching on the television, and you understand it's an impulse. You understand it's something that's not going to be helpful, but you cannot not give in to that impulse. So what he was trying to say is that if you actually start seeing these sort of impulses where that's not going to be good for you, but you can't help it at the same time, a bit like, Zizek's interpretation of Lacanian jouissance that we're talking about in the study group. So when you sort of do that, what if you just stop for a while as you notice it, and you just relax into it and observe it and see what happens next, see what form it takes, see how the impulse tries to get to you or doesn't get to you, see how long it stays, try to welcome it the best way possible. And I've now started to apply it to myself. And he said, it's not easy, but see it as spiritual practice designed for you, right? And I was like, wow, so elegant, so simple, and so useful. So today I had a client in therapy, and of course I won't tell you anything confidential about her, but this is a girl that for all kinds of reasons has a serious problem with jealousy with all her boyfriends. So we talked about the history of it and where it comes from, and I revisited all of that that psychologists need to do. And then I said, I know exactly what to do with her. Now all I have to do over the next couple of weeks is to get her to map the impulses that she knows, are not very good for her. Some of them, not all, but she can't give in to them. She can't help giving in to them anyway, And I said, so once we get a sense of it, what we're going to do is that we're going to try to work with the ones that are easier to resist. Maybe they have to do with food, maybe they have to do with switching on the television, the phone. We're going to try to work with them and apply some, I didn't call it meditation, but apply some breathing and relaxation techniques so that you can just observe when those impulses are there. And if you can resist them, what happens? Ever since a curiosity, investigate. And then obviously what I'm going to do over the next sessions is to get it to move to the impulses that are even harder to resist, namely jealousy. So it's a form of graded exposure in psychology that combines what Eckhart Tolle is saying about resisting impulse, becoming a form of spiritual practice designed for you. And so, Roshi, when you were talking about, burning your hand, it's not the same example because you didn't choose to burn your hand. You didn't have an impulse to burn your hand. But it sort of took me to this thought that what if we get these minor moments of everyday life that we don't necessarily wish for, but we really welcome them with gratitude as a teaching to be uncovered, right? How great is that? Even when it doesn't feel great in the moment, right? And those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Pedro. Yeah. Ursuline, you have your hand up.
Okay. Hello. I'm a friend of Debbie's, and I joined the meditation a couple of mornings last week. And I'm not a practicer of Zen, but I have from time to time made attempts to practice meditation. And I don't know if I should mention this, but it was so interesting when you mentioned Jesus Christ Superstar, because when I lived in New York anyway, I did a national touring company of that show. So all those things that you were saying, I had an immediate reaction to them. It kind of took me back a bit. I was struck by the thing you said, and I wrote it down. The best way to prepare for death is to live life fully. And I really like that, because recently I've been just a little bit stuck and kind of wondering, okay, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do next? How can I get there? And so forth and so on. And I thought about, let's see, what else did you say? Yes, I like the idea of giving yourself over to whatever you're doing fully. I like that very much. And you almost said it. I think you were talking about another book, but I was reminded of that book, Ram Dass, Be Here Now.
Exactly.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think of that. And I thought of another one. I think it was by Byron Katie. It's called Loving What Is. And of course, we can't, and for me, it was a book about acceptance, rather than fighting against certain things. I'm not sure how far to take that. There are certain situations in life, that you say, okay, well, I'm just gonna love this. I'm gonna sit here and take this. If I'm in a country where people are running, shooting at me and carrying on, I don't think I'd be very peaceful about that. But I do like the idea, because there are things we can't do anything about, and they're just situations. And if we can stop fighting and just, as he says, be here now. And be a part of that situation and really go deeply into it. Sometimes I have been able to find peace of mind by acceptance. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly it, huh? That because immediately our mind, when we say we have to accept things, we have to accept things, then we think that, okay, well, then we're fine with war in Ukraine, and we're fine with people starving in Gaza and whatever.
Exactly.
And that's not what that means when we say accept, to not resist. It's in fact the opposite. It's to not roll over and play dead when we're confronted with things that are not appropriate, you know. And those things that we, you know, you said it, it's like, well, violence arises from resistance and being and clinging to a position, another place, projecting ahead, hanging on to the past, dividing, creating borders. And that's where violence arises. Whereas peace is not doing that, to not hanging on, to just being with what is. And then we don't know what, how we will respond to that. But sometimes it's clear when you pick up a burning pan, well, it's clear you drop it, you know. I didn't
good
have to
idea. Very good. I do. No, but something in the things you were saying also made me think that quite often while being engaged in one activity, my mind is racing ahead to the next thing that has to be done, or going backwards, that something I wish had happened better, in a better way, that I had responded in a better way. So all these things have come to mind. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, if no one, oh, Debbie, please go ahead.
Nice to see you all as usual. I was saying, Carla, I was just thinking about her this afternoon, and there she is. Yeah, this is Joaz, the Gal du Nord. What is Dharma, the Gal du Nord, which has become kind of my fetish place. I have all kinds of wonderful things happen to me, the Gal du Nord, thanks to that remark. And I just thought, just in passing, it was very odd because I kind of, it wasn't the same event, but I had the same reflection. This morning I took some cushions to the laundromat because my washing machine's kind of, this whole building washing machine problems. And while it was going around, it burst open, which was not my plan at all. I really wanted to get this through this fast. Let's do the laundry, get these cushions out of here, and let's not dawdle. I had a whole bunch of much more interesting things to do, and now I had the contents of this cushion in everything. It was in the machine, it was in my other laundry, it was on the floor. How much can I have to get out of the machine because I don't want to leave it for other people? And I started having this really, really annoyed moment, which just makes it worse. And the practice really does, it's the Gal du Nord. Just suck it up, I guess is the other way of saying it. But not getting, I've been thinking about this about the weather, because I've been going on quite a bit about the weather recently, saying the reason we're unhappy in the Paris area is because of this weather. And then also thinking, that's not going to get me anywhere. I mean, and being weather reactive in this area is just, and being reactive to the fact that there's the contents of this foam rubber is everywhere now, and my whole day has changed. Is just isn't, doesn't pay when you can do it. I don't work, so if I have to spend an hour sorting out the foam rubber, it's not the same thing as when you have three kids and you got to get the groceries and everything. But no, I totally hear what you're saying.
Yep. Okay, well, if no one has anything more to add. Oh, Claudia would like to say something.
Yeah, hello. Hello, everybody. I want to say something, but I don't know exactly how to connect. I mean, yes, it's precisely connected to what you said, but I don't know how to explain exactly. But it happened, something happened this week, very, how can I say that? But it's because you were talking about to live fully. And it was something during my yoga practice. It's just because at the moment I'm doing a lot of I'm playing a lot of guitar and I'm doing a lot of yoga. And there was something in my while I was practicing my yoga, I was thinking that I had like not an illumination, but I got connected with my guitar. I knew I was doing exactly the same attention to my body, that I was giving the same attention to my fingers when I was playing guitar. I don't know, I'm sorry, it's a little, that's why I couldn't explain it exactly, but I made the connection. It was so funny. I was like trying to be in a way with my body during the yoga class, and I could see that that was exactly what I was doing with my fingers playing guitar. I don't know. I made the connection, and it was just because at that moment, if I was not fully there with my whole body, and exactly when I play guitar, this, especially what I'm playing at the moment, it's a classic part. And if I'm not like so concentrate on my fingers, if my fingers they don't do exactly what they have to do, it doesn't go out. So I mean the music doesn't exist. So and there was exactly the same thing for the yoga. So it's really interesting because it's because I'm practicing a lot at the moment. Maybe I'm practicing a lot my yoga and I'm practicing a lot of my guitar, and I think it's nice because. So I think maybe I'm really fully there when I'm practicing because I'm doing it a lot and more and more and something really interesting is happening in these two things that I'm doing very regularly and I can connect that to at the moment with this new job I have. What is really interesting is that to I'm doing what I'm used to do, I'm doing what I normally do every day, but I don't know why it sounds totally new. It's like the same gesture. I'm filming. I have to film people and I have to edit a film. And but there is something new in that. Maybe it's because to be in that place. But it's really like if I was filming for the first time or if I was thinking a film for the first time, I don't know where it comes from, but it's very very it's very nice to feel that. Like I feel I'm same thing, I feel I'm fully there and I'm really like very present to what is happening to me at the moment. So maybe it's because it's new, but it's nice. I can feel it when I rest. I'm like I've done something very complete. It's like the feeling that I'm doing complete things. It's very okay. It's very nice to experience that.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. That's and it sounds, I was going to say it's simple, but it's not always easy. It's simple to just be fully with what is, and yet it's not easy always, you know. It's almost like a blessing or something when it is. It's beautiful. But it is possible with practice. Like you say, you know, the more because you're playing, you're doing it so much and you're practicing and practicing, then it becomes more that. And it spills out into the rest of your life as well. Oh, you're muted. We can't hear.
Okay. No, I'm just want to, and it's funny because I mean, I cannot meditate every morning lately, like I used to do it, and I really can feel the difference. It's amazing. It's like really, my mind is going very fast, really faster than usually. So I think it's interesting to see the difference that way. I mean, okay, so if I don't meditate as usual, it's going to be different for sure. I can feel it. I can. So it's what you say about practice. So.
Absolutely.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
I babbled away a moment ago, so it may seem strange asking this question now. But as I said, I've had, you know, ins and outs of meditation. I am not sure what I'm supposed to do while we're sitting here for 45 minutes. And the way I try to quiet my mind is, I'm sure everybody is familiar with the exercise where you calm, breathe into each part of your body, your arm, your leg, and all that. And that's how I try to center myself. And also I don't worry when my mind goes everywhere, all over the place, because I've read many times that that's what happens and you just bring yourself back to what you're doing. Well, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing. And you probably are going to say, don't do anything. But I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, no, I don't think I would say don't do anything. your technique of the breathing, that's entirely a possibility. Another possibility is to just count the breath. So you breathe in and then you breathe out and that's one. You breathe in, you breathe out, and that's two. Breathe in, breathe out, that's three. And you do that until you get to 10, and then you start over again. If you get to 10. If you don't, if your mind starts wandering, like you said, and you realize that your mind is wandering, then you just say, oh, I'm wandering. And you come back and you start over again. You don't worry if you were at 5 or 7 or 3. You just start over at 0 again. The key thing is that moment when you realize you're drifting, because then you're really there. Then you're like, ah, I was drifting. Now I'm here. And so, but then quickly you'll start entering into a thing. I shouldn't be drifting. I'm not good at this practice. This practice is stupid. Oh, but I really do have to think about that thing I have to do later, whatever. But no, you just come back to counting. Again and again and again and again. So you were already pretty much doing it with your other technique. And if that other technique works for you, stay with it. That's good enough, you know. That's all you need to do, really.
Thank you.
Well, we are about out of time, so maybe we'll stop there.